Hello, and welcome to the Austin Therapy Podcast. I'm Kate. I have a background in psychology and I have read all of Jane Austen, and I am joined by my sibling,
Teresa, and I have a background in social work and have no experience reading Jane Austen except for the chapters we've read so far in this podcast.
And today we are discussing chapters 47, 48, and 49 of Pride and Prejudice.
And I will say these were some of my least favorite chapters we've read it. I feel like there was a point where things picked up again and it was getting exciting and I was getting really into it. And then I was like, why are we back in the really descriptive, boring chapters? I don't want that. I just want plot driven, which maybe says more about me than Jane Austen. So I recognize that that's probably my issue, not a Jane Austen or a Pride and Prejudice issue. But I did find these chapters a little bit harder to read, maybe. I want to get back to the love story. This has nothing to do with the love story so far. And maybe it will down the line, but right now it's just a subplot that I don't care about.
Which is, I think that's the thing about Jane Austen. You can read it for the romance and you can read it for the political subtext and you can read it for the characters. And there's going to be bits and pieces of it that you love and you don't love for those reasons.
I think that makes sense. And I wonder if my experience might be similar to other first-time readers, that you read Jane Austen mostly for the love story, because that's what you vaguely know kind of happens in it. And then maybe as you read it again, or as you read more, you become more interested in some of the other subplots and character development and things like that. I don't know if that's true for other first-time readers. If we have any first-time readers who are reading along with us, let us know. But yeah, I don't know about that.
Yeah. Well, what did you think of chapter 47?
There was a lot in chapter 47 where I just kept being like, people are naive. Why do we keep trying to be like, let's give Wickham the benefit of the doubt? Maybe he's not as horrible as he actually is. And I was like, no, he's just a monster. And we've talked about this before, that there has to be a Collins stan out there has to be a Wickham stan out there too. And for those people, I'm sorry. But like, I just don't feel like there's any.
I have heard people say they are sorry for Wickham.
Really?
Yeah.
They feel bad. Like, they feel
That
bad for him?
he's stuck with Lydia.
Oh, I mean, oh, interesting thought. I maybe get where people get that idea from. And I don't feel bad for him. I'm not going to pretend that I do. I think he's a horrible, evil human from what I know. But I did write down several times. I still can't figure out what his motivation is.
Well, and this is something that Mr. Gardner talks about too, that how could Wickham have any other motive than love? Because Lydia has nothing to offer. There's no temptation. I think his temptation is not adequate to the risk.
Yeah, I highlighted that too.
And one, my brain goes, oh, okay, so there are circumstances where you would see this as not acceptable, but logical and reasonable behavior for a young man to run off with a woman and ruin her. Okay, so this is a weird society that we live in, that this is how we are framing what he has done
Right.
as a risk-benefit analysis. Okay, that's great. But there's also that layer of trying to figure out Wickham's motives. And I think this is something that puzzles a lot of people. When people who have impulsive urges do harmful and evil things because they have been taught to center their life around themselves. And whether or not that's protective or not, it's abusive behavior. And abusive behavior makes no sense. It's not logical. And so seeking logic is exactly what victims do. It's kind of like we have to figure out a way that this makes sense. But the thing is, Wickham is not someone who makes sense. He is acting solely from this place of I need to self-serve.
And I wonder if some of it is like that instant gratification, whatever his initial motive is, and maybe we find that out, maybe we don't. Maybe there's some motive about sex and Lydia's young, and like reasonably what we know of the Bennet sisters is they're all quite beautiful. She's available, she's naive, it's someone he can, maybe manipulate. I don't know. Like, there's a lot of what feels like grooming to me in what Wickham has maybe done and how this has maybe come about. I have some interesting feelings about that. And yeah, like, how do you equate that to feeling bad for him? I just don't.
Mm. I mean, I think definitely the people who have that perspective, one, have maybe not read the book or haven't in a long time. Because I think if you read this book without the context of the history, like, that the profound impact of what Lydia has done. And
oh, yeah.
Like, if you don't understand marriage rights and all of that stuff, and you're just reading this book as because they assigned it to you in English class, and your brain goes to, well, why did he have to get stuck marrying her?
Right. If you don't take the historical context into account.
And yeah, there is that odd layer of, like, maybe I could understand if you read the book, but sometimes I think people are just coming from, like, watching the film or watching the movie and, again, not having the full context. But to me, Wickham telegraphs completely as abusive. I think you're definitely right that he seems to really like children. Like, his,
you know, that he had a thing with Darcy's sister, who's quite young. Now Lydia, who's quite 15 young
at the time. He met Lydia when she was 15.
Yeah. And he's how old? Like, in his 20s, mid 20s?
Yeah. We assume he's like 26. He's like like 10 years older than them.
Yeah. Which, like, back then isn't super uncommon, but even then, like, that is quite a significant age gap.
And it's something he's been in pursuit of. Right. And it is something that predators very much do. They target people who are vulnerable and new to social groups. So he is targeting young people who are new and lack protection. Even though Georgiana has protection from her brother, she didn't at the time have sufficient protection around her. And I think it's interesting that we're seeing something very similar play out with Lydia, who has family protection. And in general, you're not going to make a move in Meryton.
Right. But as soon as they leave,
that's when he decides to take action. He's a complete predator. It's so icky and gross.
Yeah. And I end up feeling really bad for Lydia throughout all these chapters, and partially, like, the way people talk about her. I feel bad that that's kind of how people think of her. And some of it, I know I have been quite harsh on Lydia in our podcast, and that she's sometimes a character that really grates me. But even this line of Wickham will never marry a woman without some money. He cannot afford it. And what claims has Lydia? What attractions has she beyond youth, health, and good humor? And it's just like, it makes me sad that that's what she's reduced to. And okay, maybe it's true, but I just, like, I want better for Lydia, I suppose. And I end up feeling bad for her in this scenario.
What do you think Lizzie is thinking about Lydia?
My feelings, and I often think, while I've been reading, I often put myself into Lizzie's shoes. That's kind of the way it's written, is that she's your main protagonist, so that's who you're kind of following along with. So I often find myself thinking a mixture of being sad about Lydia, scared, and a little angry of, like, how could you be so stupid? I think there is a lot also, though, of Lizzie taking on some guilt of, I could have protected her, I could have warned her, if only I had let people know how horrible Wickham actually was. This all could have been prevented. And so I do think there is an aspect of that from Lizzie's perspective that I end up feeling bad for, because I don't actually think Lizzie could have done anything differently.
It's interesting, because as I was reading, specifically what comes after that passage you quoted, where Lizzie is starting to, like, talk out Wickham's motives, and she basically says that Lydia was an easy target. She doesn't have any brothers, and from the behavior of our father, Wickham would know she was easy prey. And then she goes on to critique her mother. And I, like, the note that I just made is, do you think that Lizzie is blaming her parents?
So it's interesting that you think, is she mad at her parents? Because I wrote down, yes, be mad at him, related to the comments about her dad. He really hasn't been doing what he's supposed to do. And yeah, they are a little bit to blame. I mean, they sent their naive 16-year-old off to live with a group of men who they don't really know. And we're like, it'll be fine. Let's not worry about it. And like, I think I'm a little mad at them. I often take Lizzie's perspective, and it's complicated, right? It's complicated that these are her parents. She loves her parents, and they're not perfect. They make mistakes. They've done something wrong. She's mad at them. And so I do think Lizzie's a little mad at them, while also still holding that she loves them and she cares for them. I'm also a little mad at Mrs. Bennett.
Because she's very easy to be mad at.
Yeah.
I think what I read in those few paragraphs there is Lizzie's defense of Lydia and how could Lydia have ever known. And I think this gets echoed when there's just that part where they find out that they're to be married. And Elizabeth is that they should marry, small as is their chance of happiness and wretched as is his character. We are forced to rejoice. Oh, Lydia. And it sounds like she's crying for Lydia, not that she's mad at Lydia. She feels the sadness that maybe Lydia doesn't fully feel herself, but she knows that Lydia will one day feel the impact of this, that even if Lydia is still blind to who Wickham is, that in a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, Lydia is going to look around and realize, what the fuck did I do with my life?
Yeah. And Lydia is, she's fucked over. This is not a good scenario for her. And again, you're right. She might not realize that now, but this is going to be a really unhappy life, is kind of what everyone's predicting at this point. This was not going to be pleasant for Lydia in the long run.
Yeah. Speaking of, I don't quite want to jump ahead to my notes on Mrs. Bennett because they're just literally arg over and over again.
Fair.
What did you think of the reunion between Elizabeth and Jane?
I mean, I think I often feel this when they become reunited. I feel like I felt this when Jane was sick and Lizzie went to her back at the beginning of the book. There is a little bit of this sense of relief of like, oh, okay, they're together. Things will work out. When they're together. I struggled with Jane a little bit in these chapters. Stop being so positive and trying to find the silver lining in this and trying to figure out how Wickham is going to be a good guy. I don't necessarily know if I think Jane is naive, because I don't think it's naivete. I think it's a level of innocent isn't the word either. Like overly optimistic. Like optimistic to a fault. And I just really struggle with that. And there's even a line in here before they meet again, where Lizzie's talking to her aunt and uncle. And she says, of whom does Jane ever think ill?
Mm-hmm.
And I just wrote, that's so true. And it's so frustrating for me. I don't think Jane needs to hate everyone or be a pessimist. I think it's a lovely trait to want the best for people. And like, sometimes there are just bad people in this world or people who do really bad things. And I think particularly in literature, you can write someone who is bad at heart, right? That may not be reflective of reality, but I don't think Wickham's a good guy.
I think the thing is that evil, we wish people were black and white so that we could easily hate people who are evil. I think the thing that I noticed about Jane in this, and maybe this will resonate with you, but Jane focuses on intent. She doesn't focus on impact. We see it in how she even describes her mother, that her mother means well, and that they all had the best intentions. And it's that part of Jane that feels a little like... Like you hear the damaged part of Jane when she's focusing on someone's intent instead of the impact that they've had. She's focusing on whether or not someone intended to hurt her instead of actually focusing on the harm. And I get that she might not feel in this scenario that there's been harm done against her, but there has been.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this will impact all of the sisters and maritable status. This is a huge black mark on this family.
I definitely underlined the same line of whom does Jane ever think ill? And I think there's even a line further in where I was just like, Jane, Jane. But I think that that's very much what it is. that she focuses on someone's intent and assumes that people's intentions are good and therefore that people are good, and that sometimes bad impact happens instead of actually looking at the impact and saying, how could this have been prevented?
Well, and I think it's interesting because we don't actually know what Wickham's intent was. And so she's focusing on a presumed intent versus what his actual intent was, because we don't know. We don't know his motives. That's the whole point of all of this, is we're trying to figure out what was he thinking,
right?
What were both of them thinking? And yeah, erring on that side of, and it even says it in here, she still expected that it would all end well.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wrote, oh, Jane, like, I feel for Jane in lots of ways that I almost feel like she sets herself up for disappointment a lot.
I think Jane is stoic in ways that we don't really, you have to look a little deeper to notice.
Mm-hmm.
There's in that reunion where both of them are hugging and crying and just so relieved to see each other, Jane's going through and explaining how the family's doing and how everyone is doing. And Elizabeth says, but you, how are you? You look pale. How much you must have gone through. And Jane just immediately brushes it aside and is like, no, I'm not allowed to have feelings. Let's get back to work and holding the family together. And I know this is something that we've talked about before, that both Jane and Lizzie weren't ever really given that space to have feeling. They had to keep things together. That's their job in the family. And Jane seems super soft because she does the whole, everybody's good, we have to have good intentions. But you can also hear that that's almost like a mantra that she has to tell herself to keep from sinking into despair, because it's just so close. If she actually looks at how she's doing, she'll fall apart. Yeah. So she's not going to do that. She's going to focus on people being good. She's going to focus on, how do we get through this? I'm not going to dwell on the past. I'm not going to look at what could have possibly gone different. We're just going to move forward.
And I think it's interesting that you put it in that perspective, because it makes me actually think about Lizzie and how her and Jane both are coping with the same scenario in what you would think are different ways, but are actually quite similar, in that Jane might think of everyone positively and want to think about the best intentions. Lizzie, on the other hand, is more of our pessimist, more of our like, this is all going to be horrible and bad and the world is, you know, on fire and this is not good. And yet at the core of it is, I'm going to push away the things I'm thinking about and feeling, and this is how I protect myself, and this is how I protect this family, this is how I take care of things.
Right.
It's interesting that although they might be taking different approaches to the same problem or to the same end point, they're both going to get there. And I think that's a product of how they were raised and this parentage role that they often have to take on.
Mm-hmm. We hear about the fugitives, and I always love that they're labeled the fugitives.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I guess technically at this time, they are probably breaking the law.
Yeah, I hadn't considered that, but you're probably right. They're an unwed couple, and he's essentially kidnapped her. And there is one point in here where I write, is Lydia dead? Because they haven't heard from her in a really, and I actually was like, she could be dead. We just don't know. We hope for the best, but we just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no one's heard from her. No one's seen them. No one knows what's going on.
Right.
Could be dead.
Which is why, like, there are so many layers as to why this is, it seems overdramatic in some sense. As like, ugh, okay, two people eloped. Why are we going through so much hysterics? But also, this is really serious and really dangerous in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
We can only avoid her for so long. What did you think of Mrs. Bennet's reaction?
I mean, it's over the top as always. She's always the center of attention, as expected. And I love that there is a part of it where she's like, my husband's gonna have to duel this guy and he's gonna die and then everything's gonna be horrible and what will become of me because there's nothing here for us and we're gonna get kicked out of the house. And then when it's announced he's coming back, she's like, no, but he has to stay and duel. What is he doing? It's like, So either way, he loses in your eyes. Like, he can't do the right thing here. And I don't know if anyone could do the right thing in that scenario from her perspective, because she's just a catastrophizer. Everything is total and utter catastrophe. And she's entirely beside herself. And then as soon as it's announced that they're getting married, is like, this is lovely and wonderful and the best thing ever. She has no stable emotional ground that she stands on.
I think you can also see the almost like unstable mood fluctuation even before she hears about it. And this is the first ARG that I wrote where she's talking to Mr. Gardner about making them marry. And like in the same breath starts talking about wedding clothes and giving Lydia whatever she might want. And then she goes on to talk about Mr. Bennett fighting and don't make him fight. But of course you have to make them get married and, oh, but the clothes. And you can just tell that she doesn't really understand what her priorities should be in this circumstance. And they are still very not aligned to the actual protection of her daughter, but they also kind of are, because Lydia's going to need to get married and that's what we're hoping for. So of course I'm going to want my daughter to have nice things and not be super worried about it. Make sure she knows that I'll take care of her. It's just a weird warped view that's really hard to understand and wrap my head around, but you can see that bouncing back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, even before she gets the good news that they're married. It's not good news, but it's the best news that they could hope for.
Yeah, I agree. And I love that this line of Mr. Gardner, though he assured her again of his earnest endeavors in the cause, could not avoid recommending moderation to her. And I'm just like, that's what she needs always, is someone to recommend moderation.
And I kind of wonder, he's her brother, so they've obviously interacted at some point before now. So how much does he know her? And that he's probably actually decently good at like soothing her and being like, yeah, it's okay. Like, I'm going to say, don't worry too much. Like, don't be too hopeful, but also don't worry too much. This isn't as dire as you think it is. And probably can calm her down somewhat. And I mean, I just like to think Mr. Gardner probably was the Lizzie and the Jane before she had them, in terms of like helping his sister regulate her tempers, quite possibly.
Do we know who's older of the two?
I think he's older, but no, I don't. I can't.
Okay. Yeah. Cause it does. Again, I have this wondering of what was their household like? Was he in a role of kind of parenting for her at some point in their lives? Cause he does take on a bit of that like soothing parental kind of role,
which is really like sweet. And again, speaks to how much we like the Gardners.
I know. I was going to say, throughout all of this, they remain my favorites.
I love that they talk about how Mrs. Bennett has decided that she's going to stay locked away because she's too ill to come out of her room. And the Gardners are there's a line in there and it sounds like they're basically rolling their eyes, but this works out for the better, because then only one servant is going to talk to her. Only one servant is going to get the gossip, and it's going to be someone that we trust. This is going to be better than we thought it was going to be. Plus, we can have dinner and not deal with her.
Oh, I mean, as soon as she finds out that they're going to be married, she's like, I'm going to go tell everyone, which is just so like, okay, that's your very first thought, is who can I tell? So they're right. It does make sense that only one person they trust who's not going to be spreading the gossip, which is already all over the place. They don't need more gossip out there.
But Mrs. Gardner very clearly cares. The Gardners care about the family.
Yeah.
Right? And that's just, I just love them. And I wish they could have been the parents in this book.
Oh, but I don't know if any of this would have happened if they were the parents.
No, we could have had a soft romance instead.
All right. Well, we'll add that to our fanfic list of fanfics we're writing based on Pride and Prejudice. The Gardeners as parents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What did you think of kind of some of the information that comes out about basically Wickham being horrible?
I mean, we're not surprised as readers. It sounds like everyone else is surprised. And it is interesting, particularly the gambling debts, just how quickly the whole town turns on him. He seemed like he was this great guy. Everyone really liked him. He was probably the favorite of everyone in the militia who was there. And then as soon as all of this starts going on, people are like, oh, he owes you money? He owes me money. What? He owes all this money? And everyone turns on him so quickly. So it's interesting to me to think about when they were in, what's the town that's by Darcy's house?
Oh, Lambton. You're thinking Lambton.
Lambton. Yes. There was also a little bit of talk of, he's not super well liked around here. He's the guy who leaves the bad aftertaste. He might be great in the moment, but bad aftertaste after he leaves.
It's a very common thing that you see with narcissists, that once the mask sort of slips, their ploys no longer are working because they've run out of charm and don't have any assets to make up for their gambling debts, or they can't cover up the horrible things that they're doing anymore. It falls pretty quickly.
Oh yeah. And it crumbles quickly. And I think this is one of the places where I wrote, like, poor Lydia, she is getting trapped into something that's not going to be good. Because what I'm envisioning, and this isn't necessarily said, but what I'm envisioning is that Wickham has a gambling addiction and a gambling problem, and she's going to live her life completely destitute because he will spend every penny that is sent his way on gambling, and he's clearly very bad at it. So I just, it makes me feel for Lydia again, that this is a horrible match, and it's the best match they can ask for at this point in time.
I want to say more lovely things about sisters and Elizabeth and Jane very clearly leaning on each other, in Elizabeth wishing she could have been there with Jane. They're providing each other with support. They're basically going through and like doing a little bit of detective work on their own to like, what are the facts as we know them? And like keep doing a review. And I just love that. As much as the love story is an important piece to this, I think the sisterly friendship in many of Austen's novels, but particularly this one, is a strong emphasis of what the writing is about.
Did Jane Austen have siblings?
Jane Austen did have siblings. She was particularly close with her sister Cassandra, and her older brother Henry.
I think that they have a very lovely relationship, as we've seen throughout this, between Jane and Lizzie. And actually, we've talked about in the past that Jane Austen often gives these like really poignant things to say to some of our like lesser side characters. And there's some of like what Mary has to say to Elizabeth when they like finally talk about what's going on. And all I wrote was, what the fuck, Mary? Nothing? Then this? Like, this is what's coming out of your mouth? You say nothing ever, and then like this is what you have to share with us? And I just, it was one of those moments where I was like, yep, this is why Mary's here, right? Like, Mary's not actually a super consequential character to anything. Like, what we know of her is she likes to read books, and then she's like dropping some like really, Lizzie doesn't know how to respond
because she's shocked.
Yeah.
The thing that the note that I wrote, and this isn't exactly being fair to Mary, so I might go on and explain this a little bit more, but the thing that I wrote is, it's like a robot trying to connect with someone.
Yes, I did have that feeling too. Of like, this is like, it just feels very out of place.
And I think part of that is that Mary consumes a very specific media. She doesn't have, her worldview doesn't get challenged. She doesn't have those in-depth philosophical conversations. She believes what she believes, and she's been a little bit brainwashed with misogyny. And she's like a female Collins in some ways. The level of awkward interruption that she's doing basically to put someone down, it's really weird. Like, and I think Mary saying this like under her breath to her, at the dinner table, just being like, yeah, our sister's a whore.
Yeah.
It's like, what the fuck did, okay. And yeah.
Well, and I just love this line that Lizzie just doesn't respond because she's like, I don't know what to say to you. And it's, Mary, however, continued to console herself with such kind of moral extractions from evil before them. And it, like, it, it's one of those things where she's talking to Lizzie, but she's not actually talking to Lizzie. She's just talking to herself. And Lizzie just happens to be there.
And I think there's that point that it feels super disingenuous, and sort of that robotic feeling is where she tries to, but we must stem the tide of malice and pour into the wounded bosoms of each other the balm of sisterly consolation. Like, you're not a good sister.
No.
So it's this weird false warmth that she's trying to give off, but she's not actually looking for connection.
It also feels a little bit like she swallowed a thesaurus. Like, all of those words, like,
well, it's regurgitated, right?
Yeah, they individually mean something, but you read it and there is no feeling behind those words.
Mm-hmm. There's no conviction. It's clear that Mary believes something because she's read it, not because she's thought it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That it is, yeah, it's lifted off of a page from somewhere. I'd be interested to see who Mary ends up with. Does she ever marry? Does she end up with the Collins? Do they have a weird marriage where they like are just robots together?
Maybe we'll find out.
Maybe. I guess, yeah, we could. Although we don't have that much book left, and I feel like for Lizzie to find someone, I'm still hoping for Jane and Bingley to work out, and for Lydia to be getting married. That's a lot of marriages all at once. So I'm just gonna guess that Mary doesn't get married.
I mean, there's like an epilogue chapter.
I guess, yeah.
So anyway, back to the present. Mr. Gardner sets out to go find Mr. Bennett. Mrs. Gardner was going to remain for a few days to help out with Mrs. Bennett. And then, yeah, there's this mention of Lizzie could probably tell us more about Wickham's connections. And Lizzie's like, I don't know what the fuck they're talking about. I know you know everything I know.
She knows some things about Wickham, but they don't have anything to do with this mm-hmm. in that way.
Yeah. And then there's this letter that comes from Collins.
Oh my God, this letter.
So I'm going to get your unfiltered thoughts before I interject with some questions.
So as soon as I hear or read that there was a letter from Mr. Collins, all I wrote was fuck off. And like some of that is I don't like him. And so I will admit that always influences my reading of anything related to Collins. I don't like him. And I'm very clear about that. And then two sentences in, I wrote, go fuck yourself, Collins. So we're doing really great. And then less than a paragraph in, I wrote, seriously, fuck you. And then I wrote, I hate you. Oh, fuck off. And really, so those were my notes on this section. I was very displeased with it.
Oh, Collins is horrible.
Yeah, he's just horrible. I don't even know what's going through his mind when he's writing this. What does he expect this to offer to the family or offer to Mr. Bennett other than like, hey, I'm a royal dick.
So I think this is very much a mouthpiece for Jane Austen to critique the perspectives at the time, because this was very much the perspective that many people had. The death of your daughter would have been a blessing in comparison to this, that very framing this sort of occurrence as death to a female. So I think that there's a piece of Jane Austen using Collins to bring that in while also making Collins a character that we hate as a way for her to say, if you hold these views, you need to challenge them because you have the same views as Mr. Collins.
Right.
That's not a good thing.
Yeah.
So I think that is the literary purpose of inserting this in. The question that I had for you, based off some of the conversation that we've had before for Collins, do you think that Collins reads or makes Charlotte read her mail to him?
Are you asking if he reads Charlotte's mail?
Does he read Charlotte's mail or basically make her open it up and read it to him? She has no privacy.
I mean, we've talked about that before, that it often seems censored, what we're hearing from Charlotte. I think it's probably likely that he does. There's no way Lizzie can't send anything to Charlotte that feels confidential.
Right. And there's just this line in here, as my dear Charlotte informs me, and the back of my brain goes, Charlotte wouldn't have told you jack shit
because she protects Lizzie. And we know this because she hasn't told you about private things that she's talked to Lizzie about. So is this a letter that she got from her parents, who her mom, who's been coming and visiting and knows what's been going on, and you've made her read it out loud to you because she's not allowed to have private correspondence?
It's totally possible. And I mean, he's a horrible gossip also, because he like essentially is like, so I also told Lady Catherine and her daughter.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This is going to totally screw your family over. Let me spread this rumor about.
Right. And let me tell, like, possibly the most powerful person in this circle.
Oh, the most powerful person in my circle. Yeah.
We know Lady Catherine loves some gossip, too. Right. So they don't even live in that town, and everyone in that town knows what's going on. You know, so they're dealing with it at home, and now they're dealing with it on that front, too. I just was so angry while reading this, and the way you put it, of this being a literary device from Jane Austen, makes a lot of sense to me, because otherwise it's just like, you're just writing this to be an asshole. There's no useful purpose of this. You have very little relationship with this family in all reality, mm-hmm. other than you came to visit recently because you're going to eventually kick them all out of their house, and him offering his advice of throw her away and pretend and just disown her and pretend like this never happened to your family is wholly unhelpful.
It's Collins is someone who very clearly enjoys having power and enjoys displaying it. And that's what this feels entirely like.
Mm-hmm. And I would expect that if he was the parent figure in this, you know, if it was his daughter who had run off with a victim, he would have disowned them right away. No question about it.
There's a part of me reading this and I'm thinking about parents who kick out their kids who come out. And and I was like, yep, this sentiment still is something that is active within our society, that there is ever something that your kid can do that would make you stop loving them and wish they were dead or consider them dead. It's like, ugh, that Colin still feels familiar is so gross.
Yeah. Yeah. He is an archetype for a very specific type of people, or a very specific mindset, maybe not type of people, but a very specific mindset of what affection and love should look like.
And it's entirely conditional.
Yeah, entirely. It just makes me really frustrated. I had a thought of, so Jane and Lizzie are the ones who read this letter. Do they share this with their father?
I feel like they would have held this back.
I would have burnt this if I was them. I would have been like, nope, this letter should not see the light of day ever, and our father should not read this.
Yes, except that he's going to have to correspond with Collins at some point, who's going to ask about the letter. But I also think that Mr. Bennett, when he's in better spirits, is the type who would know how to give Collins the right sort of put down without it being aggressive. Like, Mr. Bennett talks about being amused by Collins. Like, Collins is like a little fly that he's just like, whatever, go away.
Right.
He's annoying, but he doesn't actually have power over Mr. Bennett.
Although, I mean, I wonder if the gravity of this situation would change that for him, that there is some level of realization on Mr. Bennett's part of how he has failed his children and how he's a little bit to blame for that. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder if there's part of this where he's leaving his family to Collins and Collins is doing after he dies.
I think Mr. Bennett's maybe woken up to the urgency of his circumstances, and that if he cares for his family, he needs to step up.
Yes.
I don't know how much he's going to step up. I mean, after admitting to Lizzie that he needs to feel his blame, he basically says, don't worry too much. Even this will pass and I'll go back to my old ways.
Right. I'll go back to my old ways until Kitty runs away. Like, what?
He's going to wait until Kitty runs away to be able to have his own fit and stay in his room and get served. And he's making fun of his wife. Mr. Bennett's going to be fine. He's barely learned his lesson.
Oh, yeah. And he is being such a jerk to Kitty in the end of this chapter when he gets back.
Well, I mean, yes and no. Some of the boundaries that he set are not that crazy. To not have an officer enter the house. Okay, sure.
Okay, yeah.
Maybe you can't control whether or not they pass through the village, but balls will be prohibited unless you go with one of your sisters. Okay, your daughter should have a good chaperone.
Chaperone, yeah.
That you can't go outside unless you spend every 10 minutes every day in a rational manner. 10 freaking minutes. He's asking for 10 freaking minutes.
Which I know, yes, he's asking for 10 minutes and it doesn't seem like a lot. But what is the underhand of this is him saying, you're never rational. Like he is insulting her in some way of like, don't worry, you're never going to leave this house because you're never going to be able to be rational for 10 minutes. Like I've set the bar real low for you. And that just like, I just felt for Kitty in that. And again, Kitty, not my favorite character, but I get why. I mean, she's taking the threats seriously. And so that's why she's crying. I take it as like, he's insulting you. And that would make me cry.
It's interesting because I mean, as much as I'm a critic of Mr. Bennett, that's not how I read it.
And I also think maybe I read it that way because at the end, he's also like, if you're a good girl for the next 10 years, I'll buy you something fancy, essentially, is what he's saying. I will take you to a review at the end of them. Like, I just, it just feels... I don't know. There's something about it that I'm like, you're just being mean for the sake of being mean right now.
That's Mr. Bennett.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I'm not saying that's wrong of his character. What I'm saying is that it's just, it's hard because I don't think Kitty ever gets the brunt of it.
Which is interesting because my brain is going like, Mr. Bennett, he insults his wife all of the time. He teases his children. He teases his wife in front of his children. He's not very nice and sort of mean about his neighbors. How did Jane twist that around intent? And that she obviously had to be like, my father teases my mother because obviously he seeks amusement in that. And that's something that keeps them together. I know deep down he cares for her. Like the mental gymnastics that she would have had to do to make her father's intention nice, because even though there's nothing in it, what he says that is going to have a huge impact. He's just joking around. So he's not going to have he's not actually going to follow through and not go visit Bingley. Like the impact doesn't turn out to be the same as the intent. I don't know. There's just like something in there where I'm thinking about the mental gymnastics that Jane would have had to do.
Yeah. I hadn't considered how that might play out for her. We don't hear a ton about their relationship though.
No,
we don't hear a ton about, you know, what Jane and Mr. Bennett's relationship looks like. And I wonder, it does seem like Jane is the one who cares for their mother out of her and Lizzie, and Lizzie's the one who cares for her father. And so like, I wonder if they split that role.
Yeah, maybe.
And so maybe there's less mental gymnastics that Jane has to do because she just doesn't bear the brunt of it or see the brunt of it. Certainly she's still doing a lot of it, but I wonder if some of that divide
doesn't get offloaded in the same way. Yeah. What did you think about the resolution that we get communicated?
I mean, it's bittersweet. And we've talked about that, in that Lizzie also kind of has this like, we shouldn't be happy, but we also kind of have to be happy with this as our resolution. I thought about it as, well, Lydia's not dead. Would you rather a dead sister or a sister married to a guy that you absolutely hate and is horrible? I don't know. Of the two, I guess that's the better option. I do have lots of like lovely feelings towards Mr. Gardner in this. He's handling things and is caring for his family in the most lovely way that he doesn't actually have the obligation to do.
Right.
But I again get this feeling of he's just a stand-up guy. He's a good egg. We like him.
Yeah, he spends a lot of money.
He does spend a lot of money that presumably he doesn't have a ton of.
Nope.
And like this is going to make a really big impact on his family in the long run. Mm-hmm. I did have this like tiny thought in the back of my mind, and we don't know, but I was like, did Darcy pay off Wickham at some point? Is that where the money's coming from? Do the Gardeners actually have enough money to do this, or is there a like third party person? Mm-hmm. And my mind goes to Darcy because he's in love with Lizzie.
Right.
We don't know, but maybe we'll find out.
Yeah. Because as Mr. Bennett says, Wickham's a fool if he takes her with a farthing less than 10,000 pounds.
Yeah.
It's a lot of money.
Yeah. It's what, 100 a year is what they agreed on.
Yeah.
And then her share of like 5,000 pounds, which divided amongst six of them, is not a ton of money. And of what we know of Wickham, his motive is financial most of the time.
Yeah.
So again, we come back to this, like, what's his motive in this? Why is he agreeing to this? How does this happen? I don't even know if paying off all his gambling debts would be enough for him. Like, I still feel a little bit perplexed.
Yeah, that there's something that we're missing, that this went mm-hmm. from like, they're never going to get married to they're getting married. Okay. How did that happen? Yeah. And then Mrs. Bennett has what we've already discussed, her reaction, which is basically to be excited. And it's kind of gross that she just really doesn't understand the impact that this is going to have, that she's just ready to go off and celebrate. And it's just really bizarre.
Mm-hmm. It's so bizarre. It's not out of character. It's just a really sad part of who she is.
Yeah.
This is not a happy time. And she's acting as if it is. And I get the wanting to be excited for your child and excited that like at least one of your kids is married now or will be married now. I get that, but it's just her, like how overboard she goes with it and how performative she is with it just is, it feels really icky.
And that she doesn't understand the impact of what her brother has done. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't understand. She's not grateful.
Yeah. Well, she's essentially like, yeah, of course he's taking care of us because we're family, but she doesn't take into account like the impact that it actually has on him.
She's and bankrupting him.
Yeah. There's this statement of, well, if he didn't have children, and it's like, but the reality is he does have children. Mm-hmm. That's a fairy tale land that you're talking about. Yeah. Okay. If he didn't have children, then this would just be a very lovely, generous gift from him. Maybe you could get away with feeling that way. He's got lots of kids.
Yeah.
Not just a few. He's got lots of kids. And you're taking every last penny.
Yeah. And there's no gratitude there.
No.
Yeah. And she's just ready to leap up and go tell her sister who's the biggest gossip in town.
Yes. And
it's moments like that where you can sort of understand why Darcy didn't want to marry into this family.
Oh, totally. I mean, I even wrote down, I don't like this household. Like, there's just all of them all together. I'm like, this is a really chaotic family that like, I don't think I would want to be friends with them either.
Yeah, it's hard. It feels really hard to emotionally regulate in this house. So it makes sense that Lizzie and Jane have basically learned to shut things down in order to cope. I also think that I can almost understand to a certain degree why Darcy feels like he would have a better handle on this family than Bingley would have.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think Darcy knows that he could stand up and have boundaries with Mrs. Bennett and Mr. Bennett, but he knows that Bingley would just get walked all over by her. He's like, entirely. If he were living at Netherfield, she would be there every single day visiting him.
Oh, and everything would be at his expense.
Yeah.
Yeah, there would be no boundaries in that household or in that relationship. And I, in all honesty, Jane probably wouldn't set them either.
Right. Which is why I can sort of maybe understand. I don't think Darcy had all of that information. So maybe I'm being a little generous, but it's moments like these where she goes off and you're just like, I get it, Darcy. I get it.
Yes. And it's interesting too, how she talks about like how I long to see Lydia and to see dear Wickham too.
Oh,
and I'm like, no, this is not a, like, he's not a deer. He's not nice. This is bad. And all I wrote was, and kill him? Like, in all honesty, him dying is probably the best thing that could happen right now.
There's a line from Mr. Bennett. I should be sorry to think so ill of him in the very beginning of our relationship. Mr. Bennett is like, yeah, this dude's got some work to do because I want to tear him to shreds. Mm-hmm. And he's got that perspective of, fuck, could I have to be involved with this guy for the rest of my life? Ooh.
Oh, yeah. Well, and as soon as the news came in, what I wrote down was, this is going to be really awkward family dinners.
Right?
Like, this would be the type of family dinner I would want to be a fly on the wall for, because it would be chaotic and very strange. And this is not good. And we know that Lizzie and Darcy end up together because I'm not naive and stupid. And just how awkward that dinner's gonna be. All of these interactions, not good. This is gonna be bad and awkward and weird and just... I have so many feelings about what that would be like. And maybe we'll hear about one of those dinners and that will be highly entertaining and maybe very cringe.
Yeah. I was going to ask you any final thoughts.
I don't have anything else. I mean, I did find these chapters a little bit slower in that, like, why are we talking about this? I just want to hear about Darcy and Lizzie falling in love and that working out. So I'm hoping this has something to do with something other than, like, they get married and the end. I'm gonna be mad if that's how this side plot goes. Of, like, we spent that much time when we could have just been reading about Darcy and Lizzie. I'm gonna be a little mad if that's the end of it. So maybe it won't be. I guess I still have some dreams of Darcy coming in and saving the day in some way. I don't know. Maybe he murders him. I'm very into people dying, apparently, in this.
He must go.
Yeah. Honestly, I do think if Wickham died, it would be better for Lydia in lots of ways.
Probably.
So those are my final thoughts, is where's Darcy, essentially? Why haven't we... His name's not even mentioned in any of these chapters. There's one line where it says, Mrs. Gardner went away in all the perplexity about Elizabeth and her Derbyshire friend.
And then they talk about how they won't, like, Lizzie has never mentioned him, so they won't mention him. Right. So I like that he's the Derbyshire friend. Like, and I'm pretty sure we're pronouncing that wrong. It's Derbyshire or Derbyshire or Darshire or something. It doesn't make sense. Right. But I like that they've given him a nickname instead of actually just calling him Darcy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the only mention of him and I want more.
Yeah.
So that's my final thoughts. Do you have final thoughts on these chapters?
No, I think they are sometimes boring, but they're also juicy.
I don't know. It's like those weird in-between chapters where you're really annoyed with the right characters.
Yeah. I get that. I still move along. That's all I have to say. Like, let's go.
Speaking of moving along, what was your favorite quote?
So the quote I highlighted in here is at the end of chapter 47. And it's Lizzie talking about family and all the gossip and stuff that's going on and the neighbors coming to offer help. And it's, assistance is impossible, condolence insufferable. Let them triumph over us at a distance and be satisfied. And there's something about that that feels very poignant with just, like, the gravity of what's happening. I think it's one of those lines that, like, reiterates for me how deeply Lizzie is feeling this. Well, everyone else around her, it's that feeling of being at the center of the gossip mill.
Right.
And that just feels really poignant and stands out to me. What's your favorite quote?
Everyone's so horrible in this. I don't want to pick that line because I underlined it for a bad reason.
Yeah.
Right. I've got, no, Lizzie, let me once in my life feel how I've been to blame. And then I could go on a tirade about how, yes, it is your faults and be accountable, but you're never going to actually be accountable. But I won't.
There are two spots in here, and I guess I want to highlight them more for the feeling that they give than the fact that they're super profound quotes. And it's Elizabeth speaking to Jane in the first instance. But you, how are you? Cried Elizabeth. You look pale. How much you must have gone through. And then a little bit later when they're talking through Lydia's letter and the circumstances around things, And Jane is talking about taking care of their mother and that she doesn't think she's done enough. And Elizabeth says, "Your attendance upon her has been too much for you. You do not look well. Oh, that I had been with you. You have had every care and anxiety upon yourself alone." And I just think it really speaks to that bond that those two have, that sisterly love that, and it reminds us that love isn't always just a romantic thing. And I think for me, that those moments felt really powerful. I had this visual in my head of Elizabeth reaching out and touching Jane's face kind of softly to be like, "Let me take care of you." And I think those little moments in books are things that really hook you without you noticing that they did. It's not necessarily the super profound quote that pulls you in. It's those little tiny moments of affection and love in and family. Yeah.
Yeah. Those are both really sweet moments. And again, speaks to just Jane Austen's ability to create these in-depth characters who have multi-layered relationships, particularly that sibling relationship.
Mm-hmm. Which is nice since that's who we are and what we're doing.
Yeah. As siblings, it's really nice to read about nice siblings.
Right?
Yeah. In our next podcast, what chapters will we be reading, Kate?
We are going to read 50, 51, and 52.
All right. And my prediction for those chapters is, I guess Lydia's getting married. That feels pretty inevitable. You know, maybe Wickham dies and I can rejoice. I don't think so, but maybe. And I'm going to hope that Darcy shows up. I have this like feeling that he's going to be like, "I was so worried about you. I just had to come and see what was happening with your family." Or like, "I heard word that your sister got married. I am here for, I don't know why I'm here." Those are my predictions/hopes.
Okay. I like that. Well, thanks for joining us. You can follow us on Instagram at Austen Therapy Podcast. You can follow my meme account on Instagram at Austen Therapy. Yeah. If you've been enjoying, you can leave us a review. We would love that and we love hearing from everybody who's been enjoying and following along. So yeah, thanks for listening. We will see you next time.
Bye.
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 Bye.